3 of your notes dealing with the false theory of man's origin. The only real competitive theory, and that is evolution. Now remember, as we gave you a tentative ascent of man from the lowest protozoan to finally the pinnacle man, and we shall see even all evolutionists say that this is the pinnacle, that there isn't anything higher than this. The various trees, with many of them as cul-de-sacs or blind alleys, since this is all said to be hit or miss, by chance completely, nature, and they always capitalize it, you can tell they have a God. But it's nature or natural law or chance, anything but a personal, almighty, all-wise God. All evolutionists confess, somewhere in their writings, their ignorance of the how evolution took place. But not the fact. They all say it did take place. We shall see in this first gap of the non-living to the living. They all confess that there isn't any evidence whatsoever, but they still believe it in abiogenesis or spontaneous generation. We're only going to hit some of the high spots of arguments against evolution. But I think we've got enough in your notes, and we shall enlarge upon your notes to show you that it is an absolutely unproven hypothesis, which means guess. It never has gotten out of the theorizing state. Again, you can read any book you want to, and of course we have a division on here, the guesses involved. No facts. The primary fact that you'll find in all evolutionary books is that the missing links are still missing. They haven't got a one. Now we're omitting the first and greatest gap. Only to mention it now, not in your notes. And that is the gap between nothing and something. The beginning of all matter and energy. You don't even need to pick that one up because no evolutionist anywhere, and I've read hundreds of them, after hundreds of them, and the best of them, and there's not a one that has any theory whatsoever to explain the origin of matter and energy. Where did substance come from, out of which anything could evolve in the first place? I usually like to use the illustration of a Sunday school teacher who said that God made Adam and leaned him up against the fence to dry. Then he made Eve and leaned her up against the fence to dry. An old kid raised his hand. He said, "Please, sir, if they were the first couple, who made the fence?" The professor said, "Young man, shut up. It's questions like that that's ruining religion." Leave it up to a kid to find the gap. in your reasoning, if there is one there. This is an insurmountable gap between nothing and something. Now, Hebrews 11 says, by faith we understand, comprehend, that the worlds were framed as completely, fully, perfectly joined together, prepared, made by the Word of God. And it's not logos. He's not dealing with the Lord Jesus Christ as creator here. He's dealing with the spoken word. The Greek word is to speak. His spoken word. So that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. That is the best science on the face of the earth. It tells you where things start. That's the theory of origin. More than a theory, it's a fact of origin. They want all the material on hand. Ready to go. And all the energy necessary to accomplish it. With all the built-in wisdom in nature. For the multitudinous forms, designs, patterns, fulfillments, but they want it all already supplied. Inherent, they say. Already there. Now, we mention it in Christian apologetics as we deal with the whole theory of atheism. And the proof of the existence of God. And of course we use the teleological argument as well as the cosmological argument for the existence of God. Everywhere in nature there is intelligence. Until, strangely, I read an article by a great scientist not long ago, just about a month ago, where he spoke of unconscious intelligence in nature. If you ever heard of a contradiction in terms, that's it. An unconscious consciousness. The guy was unconscious when he wrote it. An expression like that. Unconscious intelligence. Might as well talk about ignorant intelligence. But they have had to postulate the eternality of matter. In other words, we have, as we say in apologetics, an infinite chain of finite links, which is an absolute absurdity. You can't have an infinite chain of finite links. You can't have a chain that has no beginning or ending, but every link in it had a beginning and ending. Hence, they have had to postulate the eternality of matter. But here's the strange thing. There are two absolutely incontrovertible laws of nature that every scientist subscribes to. You can't get very far in science or physics without subscribing to it. And that is the two laws of thermodynamics. The one is that in all the multitude of changes in nature, the sum total of energy remains the same. Now remember, matter and energy are interchangeable. This is Einstein's famous theory of relativity. In other words, matter can be changed into energy and energy into matter. And of course, the deeper you go into the atom's construction, the more you realize that the atom really is not solid substance, it's one form of energy. But the first law of thermodynamics, there isn't a physicist on the face of the earth that doesn't subscribe to these two laws. And yet, both of these are against the theory of evolution. There cannot be any advancement, in other words, to a higher plane in energy or matter. In the sum total of modern energy, and I don't care how many changes are made, if you burn a house down, you haven't destroyed anything, you haven't annihilated anything, it's all there. It's just change. It's now into gases, a lot of it's into ashes. You've changed the form of it, but you've annihilated nothing. Did you know that science knows of no annihilation, as they know of no creation? Static. That's the first law of thermodynamics. The second law is even more destroying of evolution. The second law of thermodynamics is this. In all the multitude of changes in nature, the pathway is never upward, it's always downward. It's called the law of entropy. E-N-T-R-O-P-Y. The law of entropy. Or another word they use is randomness. Another term is usefulness of energy. In other words, it never increases, it goes downward. And of course, the Bible teaches this from beginning to end. The earth is running down. We've already mentioned this in the 105 elements. Never in the change of one element to another is it reaching a higher plane. It always goes downward. The usefulness of energy is running down, and always has been as far as science is concerned. Of course, the question comes, who, why, what, where did it wind up? Here's why they invented the Big Bang Theory, as though that suddenly could increase it. It couldn't. It could redistribute it if the bang's big enough. Like an explosion. You can destroy the usefulness of that item, but you don't make it more useful by blowing it up. So, the greatest gap of all really is from nothingness to something. Everything in the universe is finite and running down. Where, when, by whom was it wound up? The heavens waxed old like a garment. The earth is wasting away. What wound it up? We're not even including that in the lesson. The first great gap that we're going to concern ourselves with is the gap between the non-living and the living. This earth is blanketed with life. This, of course, is known more now by the great microscopes. Man for millenniums didn't know anything about germs or protozoan, smallest animals, until Count von Leeuwenhoek invented the first microscope. It was a very crude outfit. He looked into a drop of water, and he exclaimed in horror, "I behold little beasties." You'll never want to drink another drop of water if you could see what you're swallowing. It's teeming with life. Every drop of ocean water is teeming with life. Every speck of sand is teeming with life. Every speck of dust is teeming with life. And in this atmosphere, this earth is absolutely a living organism almost. Everywhere. No wonder they have worried and worried over this origin of life. Now remember, evolution is supposed to be a doctrine of origins, like the origin of the species by Darwin. But it doesn't explain that first origin. And it's bothered them. And almost every evolutionist, against all evidence, now 100%, all evolutionists believes in some kind of spontaneous generation. Because if you don't have God, life is a fact. So they postulate. They not only postulate all matter and energy, but they postulate life. Life came out of nothing. And of course, this is all right for so many, many centuries and millenniums. The blowflies came out of the rotten material. Rats came by spontaneous generation out of the rag pile. Life just automatically just came upon the scene without former life, abiogenesis instead of biogenesis. Let me read from a couple of three authorities. In the book, The Evolution of the Earth and Its Inhabitants, by a Yale University president, after 112 pages of proving that spontaneous generation couldn't happen, 112 pages, 13 chapters, again and again and again, he says spontaneous generation couldn't happen. Then on page 112, at the starting of chapter 14, quotation marks. The first great crisis in the evolution of living beings was the origin of life. The marvelous, subtle combination attained by certain familiar or inorganic elements, increasing their molecular complexity until a substance was produced containing the attributes of life. Ipso facto. Pesto dominocus. Macaroni, cream cheese, and garlic. All of a sudden, here it is. Oh. 112 pages. It isn't possible. Proven by Tyndall and absolutely by Pasteur. He spiked their guns for good. Nobody's been able to create life. That mysterious thing that makes all difference in the world between the living and the dead, between life and non-life. So in another Yale textbook, Evolution of the Earth, page 82 through 93, some 2,000 words proving abiogenesis improbable by every effort they could devise. And then on page 93, he said, we thus reach the general conclusion from some other part of the universe. Life must have originated millions of years ago. He gives the alternative in this book. You either have to believe in abiogenesis or in creationism. And creationism to them is absolutely out of the question. Their atheism would go down the drain. But life is here. It's a fact. So it must have spontaneously generated. That's their idea. Haeckel, Ernest Haeckel, in the 19th century, in his History of Creation, page 348, writes, the origin of the first monera, as living cell, by spontaneous generation appears as a necessary event in the process of development of the earth. We admit that this process, as long as it is not directly observed or repeated by experiment, remains a pure hypothesis. But I must say again that this hypothesis is indispensable for the consistent, non-miraculous history of creation. How's that for assumption? It's impossible, but it has to be. Every one of them gives the same thing. Like I gave the illustration already to you, H.G. Wells, in his Outline of History. Spent 17 pages proving that, or 16 pages proving that spontaneous generation was impossible. But then he says, but of course, it must have taken place back there under more favorable conditions. That is when the earth was a molten mass without form and void. This is why they invented, and you'd be surprised how many people use it, even in this book by Yale University. One fellow by the name of Compton gave it as a fact. In the Chariot of the Gods, he intimates it, this one man. But I have an article written by a physicist who's supposed to be a Christian. Not a Christian, but a believer, but you can see he isn't. He said he studied the Bible for 30 years. In his book, First Man, Then Adam. See what he's talking about. You can buy it as a paperback on some counters, but don't waste your money on it. Most of his quotations are from the Book of Enoch and other apocryphal books. He doesn't use the Bible. It was written by Dr. Erwin Ginsberg. You could tell he's an apostate Jew. Here's his theory. And by the way, he has a lot of testimonies from Presbyterians, Congregational, and Unitarians, and in the forefront of his book, saying it's an excellent book. I thought it was awful. Here's his theory. Adam and Eve came from outer space as supernatural creatures, as astronauts. In other words, on a flying saucer. I imagine with a beanie with propeller around on the top. I don't know. Then he says the glory cloud leading Israel in the wilderness was a UFO. And he said all those wonderful plants in the Garden of Eden he brought with him on that same UFO. And he said the children of Adam and Eve married humanoids. And now here we are. And he says man was the last and most sophisticated of the animals to emerge. You'd be surprised how many quacks come out with the same theory. Even great scientists, like this one fellow in this Yale book. I have these two books, The Evolution of the Earth and The Evolution of Man, written as textbooks for Yale University. But did you know this crackpot flying saucer theory is no worse than the evolutionists give, the scientific evolutionists with their theories? In fact, that at least gives you some full-grown men and women on some other planet to come here. You see, what they do is they like to remove it far enough out and far enough back in hopes you'll forget about it. In other words, you don't ask those questions that ruin science, so-called. If it's out 100 billion light years and back 4 billion years, let's just start with the assumption that life started spontaneously and it was all there ready to start. So don't ask any more questions after that. His idea works as much as some evolutionist ideas. I cut out of the Associated Press in January 30th, 1982, in the Tampa Tribune, titled, hold your seat down good there on that thing, it's He said, human life, or human roots, lead to the soybean. I know that little Abner used to talk about human beans. But this is ridiculous. Now, it makes just as much sense as the rest of this mess. But he said there are nodules on the roots of a soybean that have one similarity in the juice of the serum of the human blood. It's that old homologies again. If you have one similarity, it outweighs a thousand disparities. All evolutionists do this. If you have an organ that even looks like the organ of a beast, it must have come from a beast. Similarities, they say, prove relationship. That's crazy. Just because a Volkswagen uses wheels to lessen friction, and so does a locomotive, it doesn't mean that by natural inherent forces, the locomotive evolved from a Volkswagen. How foolish. Coming back to your notes, part of it. The first and greatest of the gaps is between the non-living and the living. The real origin they set out to find is merely pushed back further and out further. It's not explained. It's assumed. In fact, everything that they want is assumed. It just automatically took place when they needed it. Spontaneous generation, having been long exploded and isn't believed by any competent scientists, though assumed by most, because it had to take place if there isn't any creator. For instance, Ferris, in the book Evolution of Man, says, evolution must likewise assume that under some favorable condition, the earliest living forms were evolved. What is that word assumed? Now, he does, like everybody else, later on, he asserts. He assumes and then he asserts. It's a fact. He thinks you'll forget that assumption back there. And now believe in his assertion. That under some favorable condition, the earliest living forms were evolved from the inorganic. Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, said, give me matter and I'll explain the formation of the world, but give me matter only and I cannot explain the formation of a caterpillar. Thing. It is this gap, or all of these gaps, that Lyell was supposed to explain by uniformitarianism, gradualism, all through 3 or 4 billion years, and now they're going back to 20 billion. Like I said, they're as three where there are zeros as Washington, D.C., in the Bureau of the Budget. And giving money to every Tom, Dick, and Harry and Ayatollah if they need it or want it. I notice the Lebanese president's over here now with his hands out. It's not Uncle Sam, it's Uncle Sap. And the funny part about it is, have we bought any goodwill? Who in the world loves us?
Rich Uncle Shylock. They've got all kinds of beautiful names for us. Of course, not the least is Satan that the Ayatollah calls us, Khomeini. But it, like the man said, with friends like we've got in the world, we don't need enemies. So they do enough to tear us apart. Huxley said, living matter, or said, of the causes which led to the origin of living matter, it may be said that we know absolutely nothing. Now, you can get a statement like this by almost any evolutionist in the world, if you read far enough. He'll admit, somewhere, or he'll do it by assuming, which means I'm guessing that that's the way it started. And then they go on to, like one reader, it must have taken place. It had to take place. The Encyclopedia Britannica. In it, Huxley says, the chasm between the non-living. And the living, the present state of knowledge cannot bridge. In all of these, you talk about the hopeful monster. It's not nature, it's the evolutionist. The hopeful monster by Goldschmidt was invented, about 30 years ago. I don't think most evolutionists liked his descriptive term. The idea was, gradualism has never been proven. There are no missing links. And we shall see this in the species when we come to it. The gap between species. But they invented the hopeful monster, and now they have got what they call punctuated equilibrium, which sounds a whole lot better. But you know what punctuated equilibrium means? It means that an alligator laid an egg and a chicken came out. That's exactly what it means. Some kind of an accident took place on the DNA tape. Now, it's never been seen. That's what I call hopeful. Boy, they'd love to have that. In other words, they'd love to do what Mutt and Jeff did, cross a pig with a jellyfish and get boneless ham. It won't work. Let me give you a definition. Let me show you how they love to use peculiar words. Here's Hubert Spencer's definition of evolution. I want you to hear this. Herbert Spencer's definition of evolution. Evolution is an integration of matter, a concomitant dissipation of motion during which matter passes from a differentiation. I better start that over again. I skipped a line. I don't want to miss any of this. Evolution is an integration of matter, a concomitant dissipation of motion during which matter passes from an indefinite incoherent homogeneity to a definite coherent heterogeneity. Coexistent with matter during which it retains its motion and undergoes a parallel transformation through a process of differentiation and integration. That's what you call vegetable soup. You know what he said? A vague somehow or other can't stick togetherness and an all likeness is changed to an easily described all togetherness that is unlike anything that is different. for a process of separating for a cause and combining for a convenience. I still don't know what he said. That's evolution. This gap between the living and the non-living is not bridged anywhere. They're either alive or not alive, period. There's no half alive. They've spent some teams of microbiologists have spent 30 and 40 years trying to create life. Every once in a while, National Geographic, Reader's Digest, some other evolutionary magazine will come out with a statement, life is almost created. Or the first precursors of life have taken place. So on. Precursors, I don't know how you pronounce that. And all they do is take a bunch of chemicals that they guess were in the original before they said there was any oxygen on Earth. Now, this is crazy. All of them say that it couldn't, in the process of oxygen, in its free state, all amino acids were destroyed. So there wouldn't be any chance for life to come. But they say in the original atmosphere there wasn't any oxygen, which is a foolish statement to make, since oxygen is one of the most abundant chemicals on Earth. Most abundant. Did you know almost every rock is made up primarily of oxygen? All water is oxygen. All moisture has oxygen in it. H2O. But they postulate it must have not had any oxygen or you couldn't have spontaneous generation. Abiogenesis. But it must have taken place. It had to take place. Or you've got to believe in a miraculous intervention. Which perish forbid. Look at the next gap. Is between the vegetable and the animal kingdom. There's not one missing link. Half vegetable and half animal. They say the virus comes close, and then they just discovered another one they call close. But the virus is a vegetable. The bacterium are animals. Living things that are not vegetable, they are in the animal kingdom. The only one who tries to make a half vegetable and a half animal are the fiction writers, science fiction writers. Of course, that's what they're doing also. They have walking vegetables and leafy Martians. There's not one missing link, half vegetable and half animal. The gulf between free-moving, self-propelling, self-determining creatures and vegetables is unbridged. Third is the great gap between the whole animal kingdom and man. I'm leaving out species because that's a separate division later. Proof against evolution. Between animal and man. Of course, this is the one that they've really been working on with their missing links. We'll go into that a little bit more thoroughly in apologetics, but I wish we had time here. I've got a whole file full of material on the so-called missing links. Darwin said in his Origin of the Species, I have nothing to do with origin of mental powers any more than I have to do with the origin of life itself. In what manner The mental powers were first developed in the lowest organism is as hopeless as arguing the origin of life itself. That was in The Descent of Man, page 66, not The Origin of Species. Henry Drummond, on page 135 of his Ascent of Man, says, the infinite distance between the mind of man and everything else in nature. The infinite distance. The Yale book calls it immeasurable distance between man and the greatest intelligence in nature. Ferris, in that same book, Evolution of Man, page 102, says, it must be remembered, with all of our progress, we are not far from Vesalius in the 15th century as to how the brain performs its functions in imagination, in reasoning, in thinking, and in memory. He said, I can form no opinion whatever. And then for the rest of the book, he forms opinions, trying to solve the perplexity. If evolution is a continuous process according to fixed laws, why should there be any missing links? We should have all kinds of progression from animal to man, with intelligence showing all kinds of human traits in what they call the nascent form, that is just barely developing. There should not be an isolated case found in a gorge somewhere or in a riverbed. They should be walking the earth. We should find some, all kinds of half monkeys and half humans. We've got a lot of deformed people. We've got a lot of people whose minds have been wrecked by disease or by some genetic defect, but there's no doubt about their humanity. They're not claimed as a missing link at all by the evolutionists. Why, then, is there no connection at all? Why the great gap between animal and the human? In 1 Corinthians 15:39 is one of the greatest scientific statements on the face of the earth. All flesh is not the same flesh. There is one flesh, kind of flesh of man, another flesh of beast, another of fish, another of bird. Anybody in the world that's ever cut apart a fish and a bird and so on, they know what they're cutting apart. No mistaking a piece of mullet. They tried to change to Lisa here a few years ago because they didn't like the name mullet. But people still, when they went to the fish market, asked for mullet. I've eaten mullet all my life. They used to say here in Florida we lived on mullet in the summer and tourists in the winter. Getting both of them. Not now, though. There is no genetic similarity as well as the kind of flesh itself. It's a great scientific truth. You'll find one halfway in between any of these four that he names here. Here's why they say you can train an animal, but you can't educate one. No animal on the face of the earth can you educate. All the evolutionary psychologists we have seen in our What's Wrong with the New Psychology has had to admit that man possesses some characteristics and some elements in his personality that no animal has. One of them is the reasoning faculty. Another one is the is the moral faculty. And did you know almost every evolutionist has had to classify man as a worshiping animal? What is this thing in man that wants to worship? It's universal. Now, some are bowing down to the god of science, but they're still worshiping. It's a strange thing that evolutionists, when he postulates this unconscious intelligence, make wild guesses of planning in nature, and provisions of nature. Why is provision of nature? I find this in every evolutionary book. Pattern, design, purpose. And yet, just as soon as we as Christians postulate in creationism the purpose of God, they yell, foul! That's a religion! Well, I want you to know that evolution is just as much a religion as creationism is. It's built upon plain faith. We might put another one in here. Number four. I think it ought to be a separate gap. It's a great gap. Impossible gap. And that is the creation of sex. Male and female. Not all of nature. Now, there are a few self-pollinating creatures, as well insects, as well as plants. They're bisexual. But the whole creation of male and female throughout all of nature is not just physical, as between man and woman. It is in every cell of the body. We won't go into it here as we do in our study of apologetics, where we take up embryology. But the number of chromosomes between the male, every cell in the man's body and every cell in the woman's body. In the man, there are perfectly 23 matching pairs, making up 46 in every cell. But they are perfectly matching. In the female, there are 22 perfectly matching. Rather, 21 perfectly matching. Then there are two unique cells, different kind of cells. I've got it backwards. In the woman, there are 23 perfect matching cells, 846. In the male, there are 21 perfectly matching cells. And then there are two very odd cells. They used to say 48 cells for a long time. I was taught that when I was in school. But the higher power microscope shows that the two odd ones they thought were odd were only a multiplication taking place in the matched pairs. But these two odd Y cells seemingly perish. I think the reason why the Bible always puts the genealogy in the male all the way through, and why the Bible never speaks of the seed of the woman except one time, of Jesus, who was virgin born. Always the line was considered in the male. I believe it's because of this genetics. And it's amazing. They use this now, one of the ways they could tell even from the smallest drop of dead blood, they could tell whether it came from a man or a woman, by putting it under a high 100,000 power microscope, or even a 300,000, but the 100,000 power would also give it. Don't you think that bisexuality would be a very, very great advantage for the perpetuation of the species? Why, when, and how, and where did this division of the sexes take place? if you don't take Genesis 2 in consideration. The creation of the woman by a direct fiat of God. How in the world could male and female sex come through millions of years of evolution? And what about the reproduction of the species while it's being developed? And what about the detrimental effect of any organ that's not being used? It tends to atrophy. This is one of the laws of evolution, even. In the vestigial organs, they use it. You know, evolution has always explained the dog by the tail or the tail by the dog, according to which one they're trying to explain. It's the same way they do the fossils. This is what you call circular reasoning, which is fallacious. Circular reasoning. They say that you could tell the age of the fossil by the rocks in which it's found. But then if you want the age of the rocks, you could tell by the fossils that are found with it. So it's according to which you're trying to explain. But that's circular reasoning. And they recognize it. I've read many articles where they're trying to explain their circular reasoning. Of course, they don't. What kind of cell in the DNA tape, we won't be dealing with this in this class, we deal with embryology and apologetics, but that DNA tape has to be perfect the first time. Has to be complete the first time. In it is all the life history of that individual. Even how long he used to live. What color hair? What color eyes? What color skin? How many ears you're going to have? How big? How many noses? Every characteristic. There isn't a science on the face of the earth that could tell you how the DNA tape patterns the whole life history of that individual. How many cells to make? Some 26,000 billion cells. Also, what cell is going to start making this organ? What cell is going to start making that organ? What cell is going to start making bones? What this gelatinous material in the eye? Which is going to make skin? And just how many cells to make and how to form them all so that some are the skin around the organ and some are the vessels in the organ and a complication. As they give the survival of the fittest, how could the fittest survive until it arrives? And someone has said you have to have the revival of the fittest before you have the survival of the fittest. Concerning these gaps, Dr. Alfred R. Wallace, bottom of notes of your notes on page 4, who is an associate of Darwin, said, I've always liked this admission on his part. This is before evolution became so atheistic. There must have been three interpositions, insertions, interference with divine and supernatural power to account for things as they are. I want to finish reading this. There is a gulf between matter and nothing, another between life and non-living, and a third between man and the lower creation. And science cannot bridge any of that. That's an evolutionist talking. Now, he'd like to bridge it. He'd love to die. as all of these others have, would love to have been able to say, well, at last we've done it. Eureka, we found it. We can create life. They'll never create life. I'll guarantee it. Only God can create life. You're dismissed.